Blog Talk Radio.
Occupy. It is Thursday, January 29th, believe it or not, 2015. And my name is Annie Lindstrom, your host of the show. Talkupy is about people who do good things for community and make the world a better place. This week we are having performers on. We had T-Page Del Porto, musician, photographer, poet, just about everything on Tuesday, talking about environmentalist art in West Virginia. And today we have monologuist Aaron Califato, who we'll introduce in just a second. Please visit talkupy.net, where you'll find my blog, photos, videos, and show notes when I remember to do them. I've been pretty bad about it lately, but I do intend to get back on that, as well as archives of more than 130 shows. I guess it was 134 when I looked yesterday. Also, please listen back if you like to. We've had Fractivist on. We've had a lot of fracking shows. Oil and gas shows, KXL, Art Tandarup, Damian Luzzo from California talked about Utah tar sands. And then I'm still wanting everybody to give a listen to Heather DeMayan from St. Charles, Missouri, who's a live streamer out of Ferguson, and she does her live streaming from a wheelchair. We talked about ableism, and that was a really great show for everybody to listen to because I think a lot of us don't realize how we are prejudiced and how we treat people who have disabilities very wrongly. Anyway, that was a really good show. She's funny, and I hope you'll check them all out. You can also click on the contact tab on my website to send me listener mail. I'm really grateful for any feedback. You can also send me any suggestions for future guests. I'm open to definitely getting more people that I don't know about. I find people, they just kind of float out of the air to me, but you can help if you want to. Also, before we begin, I do want to thank Ronald Jenkes for his song Disorganized Fun, which is a Talkupy theme song. Check him out at Ronald Jenkes, JenKees.com. And now, let's get on with the show. I want to welcome Aaron Califato, our monologuist and change agent, back to the show. He was on about 2 years ago. Welcome, Aaron. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing good. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're so glad to have you back. And just for people who might not remember that show, but definitely go listen back to that. That's 2 years ago. I think it's highlighted in the promo. I'm not sure, but if it isn't, I'll make sure that it is after this for everybody who listens on archive. Your show is called For Profit, and you created it yourself. It's about the for-profit higher education industry. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that and just how you started that, and then we'll talk about how it's been going, but just what it is and why you do it. Okay. I think we may have lost Aaron, but that's okay. I think I'm going to call it back. Oh, there you are, Aaron? Yeah, I got you now.
Oh, there you go.
Go ahead.
Awesome. And about the show, and it actually happened by accident about 3 years ago when I was, writing monologues and playing different clubs and venues and stuff like that and just talking about stuff that was personal to me and kind of came from a blue-collar work ethic. I'm from Cleveland, and so I always talked about things from that sort of perspective of always kind of being the underdog and always kind of having to work for what you had and kind of coming from a community of a post-industrial sort of sentiment and transitioning into a new economy. And so that's where I always wrote stuff from. But I basically taken a job at a for-profit school, which is different than a nonprofit school, obviously. But the results for most students are the same, is that you end up with ridiculous amounts of debt after you're done, and the inability to pay it back because wages haven't gone up since the 1970s in this country. And on top of that, you have all this debt, and the jobs, that you're getting with your bachelor's degrees are yielding you somewhere between $24,000 and $27,000 a year. So I was one of those people, and I took this job, and it was just an opportunity for me to write what I saw inside the for-profit educational industry, which was just a vehicle and a lens for, you know, what I think higher education can become if we don't reform it and go back to what it was originally intended to be, which is about education, teachers, students, preparing citizens, and educating our society. So I just wrote what I saw, and what I saw was pretty dangerous. It was a world of, you know, basically, you know, salesmanship and taking advantage of students and communities and people. It was about enrolling people and treating them like numbers as opposed to, you know, treating them like human beings. It was a world in which you exploited people instead of investing in them. And so I was sort of this kind of perfect candidate for being in that situation to sort of look and see and record what I saw. And then I just wrote a monologue, and I've been touring it since.
Right. And so you were an admissions counselor at one of the more famous ones. I know I don't think we mentioned it last, so we don't need to mention it. But, you know, as an admissions counselor, what was your actual job? Like, what were you actually, like when people would come in, what did you do, or how did you have to get your mindset? Because I remember you telling me that just bothered you every time you had to talk to someone because they were usually not good candidates for what you were propositioning them with.
Well, yeah, and I think the thing is, and I still won't say the name because I haven't gotten sued.
No, we don't need to.
But it was not one of the big ones. It was actually a small little for-profit. And so, but what it did was it mirrored what most of them do, which is kind of essentially their diploma mills.
Right.
And the idea is that you get people in and you get people out. And there's a reason why, particularly, they are situated in low-income neighborhoods. I mean, it's not because it's charity. You know, these places, right? I mean, you'd see these signs and you go, wow, it's great. What a great bunch of folks the University of Phoenix are. Look at them putting it in that impoverished neighborhood. Or look at ITT Tech. Look at all those commercials they have. Isn't that nice of them to put them during the daytime when unemployed folks are watching television? Isn't that a wonderful public service, right? This is not charity. It's the same reason why there's a liquor store in the corner and gun shops in our worst neighborhoods. It's because we know that there's a lot of money to be made in poverty.
But you have to go also to the point now where we have charter schools, and they're given the same legitimacy as public schools, and they get a lot of the same privileges, even though they don't pay for them. At least in New York, they don't have to pay for some of the space that they get. They just barge in and take, you know, precious space. And then other things that have been that look legitimate but really aren't, like these big car. We have a big car dealer where I am, and you know, their job is to get you into a high interest car loan and a car that they can repossess if you can't pay it. But everybody thinks it's the greatest, you know. So all these things are taking on these legitimate clothes that, you know, I think people don't become wise to it until, like you, they become someone who's employed there or someone who's been fleeced, like a student, you know, that you may have talked to and gotten into the college, or, you know, other people, you know, in your same job. But what would it be like when someone would come in to talk to you? Because I remember you talking about you would just look at them and think, oh, no.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was just a difficult situation to be in. So I was on the front lines of this sort of industry. And, you know, they called us admissions advisors. But really what we were just screening agents for financial aid. And so my job essentially was to follow a program in which I had to ask really invasive questions financially, which would make sense, you know, just like if you gave someone a loan, if you're going to. But this was not about that. This was about how much money can we get from your federal funding? How much money can you apply for through private loans? How much money will the military or your military benefits get you? And then the idea was just basically trying to get those answers. And then on top of that, what we were asked to do was then emotionally figure out ways to manipulate students to make them feel not only that they had to start, but that higher education in this venue was the thing that was going to give them value to their lives. And if they didn't, they were going to end up right where they were and right in this neighborhood that they don't want to be in. And so, I mean, look, I'm a monologist, right? So I talk for a living. and I think that it kind of borders salesmanship. I mean, if anybody that gets on a stage, you essentially are selling. I just don't sell cars; I sell ideas. That's the biggest difference. I can get on a stage and I have performative techniques. I trained as an actor, but the only difference is I'm not selling a product; I'm selling an idea. But I think that's why they hired me. And what they asked me to do, though, crossed sort of an ethical boundary, and I couldn't do that to other people. But look, Annie, at the same time, you got to pay bills, right?
Right.
And so does everybody. So does everybody. It's the same question of moral and ethics. And everybody has been situated in a business or a job in which they, oh, you know what? I don't know if I feel right doing this. But then you got a kid at home, and then you got the rent that comes in. And that, that individualistic survival, you know, thing that's in our genes to live, to survive, to be okay, takes over. And sometimes you find yourself doing things that are unethical. And so for me, that was where the play came out of, was that what you just asked about being an admissions advisor, which was exploring that space of individual prosperity and individual being an individual, a person who's safe as an individual. And then at the same time, also worrying about the community and the world around me. And the only difference was that the venue for that conversation was a venue that was had a guise of higher education.
Right. I'm just sitting here thinking about the when they got your resume, like you were probably like, yes, let's get this guy in here. I could see their eyes like spinning around saying, yes, a monologist. What, how lucky could we possibly get? Yeah, because sales, that's what sales is. And I think there's a lot of things people are doing for work these days that, you know, and I mean, myself included. I mean, my job is as a writer, and sometimes I'm writing stories, you know, it's like, you know, you gotta pay the bills, but it's like, it's very difficult when you start thinking about how are people out here in these fracking fields, or how are people, you know, doing, you know, I'm not going to say it, cause, but just things that, you know, are, you know, not so good. It's like, how can they get up in the morning and do that? But we do it all the time, you know, all around the world. And I think that, you know, you exploring that context every night on the stage, or when you get a chance to, I mean, you're not maybe every night, but hopefully you're there now. I want to talk about that too. So we met you 1 year into your show, and you had a great show with us. You had actually like 21,000 people listen. We got you featured back in the old days of Blog Talk Radio, which we can't do now because they got a little bit bigger. But hope we have a lot of people listening now. I know that because they had reserved spots. But things kind of took off for you over the last 2 years. Why don't you tell us about how things have gone and how the show has been received and what kind of feedback you've been getting on it?
Yes, I mean, I've been touring, but, you know, people say that, right? I mean, I've listened to interviews. I'm a big radio listener. Love it. And television, you know, you watch Inside the Actor's Studio. So everyone has a story, and they usually start with, like, yeah, I just started touring. It doesn't just happen. So I'm going to try to actually answer the question from a real-world perspective, as opposed to the whole idea of magic occurs. Magic doesn't occur. Magic doesn't exist. What exists is a will to with an idea, or and everybody's fought hard for that. Everyone, you know, has an idea that they want to bring to fruition. So I just really that first year I was starting to get, you know, booked, and people were watching the show. And what I really wanted to do, particularly because of this message, and I was personally affected by student debt. And as you mentioned before, it wasn't that I was just an admissions advisor. Ironically, I was also a former student who had tons of student debt that was paying off my debt with a job that was putting other people in debt. That's right. I mean, it's unbelievable. So
I forgot about
why
that
not?
Part.
You're a writer, so I only have to tell you. So, anyways,
no.
That's that world. But I wrote it, and I really worked hard. No one would host the play. There wasn't a single theater in my community. I live in Cleveland now. There wasn't a single theater that would host the play nationally as well. People weren't interested in it. They weren't interested in socially conscious work. They weren't interested in. They didn't see the viability. And so I just had to keep pushing and pushing. And so I started self-producing it and putting it up in you know, abandoned malls and churches and all this kind of stuff and putting it up. And luckily, I had a friend of mine from Seeing Place Theater in New York. It's an off Broadway spot, and they do great work there. He hosted it, and when it got hosted there, I did it for 2 weeks on the off nights, and we got some people to watch it. You know, Chronicle of Higher Ed was there, and Huffington Post and stuff, and they wrote about it. And when that happened, then conversations started, and I was able to tour the piece. And so since then, I've done over 100 performances in 20 states. Last year, we did a film version. We quickly put together a film version of the piece, and it was screened at over 35 campuses across the country for Campus Equity Week. So there's been a lot of exposure nationally with the piece, and I've been touring it. Now we're getting bigger in terms of the universities that we're going to, and primarily universities host me now, which is ironic because, and it's also a victory too from the activist perspective, which is let's take this conversation to sort of the nest, right? Let's take it to where it needs to happen, which is at these venues, in which we are saying, hey, listen, and I come in with this approach where it's, higher education is a value. So it's not militant in its nature. I'm not militant with the piece. I actually believe it. I believe higher education is such a value that it should be given free and open to every person who's willing to work for it. And so that's the premise. And that's why universities are able to host it, because I'm coming in saying, hey, we have the same idea that university is a value. The question is, how do we fund it, and how are we treating our teachers and students in that process, and our citizens in turn? And so, yeah, it's been awesome. It's been a lot of hard work. I've met a lot of really cool people. I did a great event at George Washington University this past fall with a guy named Van Jones. He's a co-host of CNN's Crossfire and a really wonderful guy. And his organization, Rebuild the Dream, helped kind of coordinate an event. So now what we're doing is we're putting together these events with just kind of bigger personalities and media types for the purpose of elevating the message. So now, you know, no one's going to sell out, you know, 1,000, you know, seat theater to see Aaron Califato because I'm an independent artist. But they'll come and they'll see, you know, this person, or they'll see that person. But what's great is the art and the conversation is drawing the attention of some of these, you know, media types and larger personalities. And we can leverage that for the sake of the message and for the sake of the event. So it's been really awesome.
Right. You know, when you say that, I want to ask you a question, because I'm a little bit disturbed, and I know some of the activists, that are involved in some of the issues over racism that are going on, you know, this past year, by some of the stars that are not speaking out, or, you know, Oprah saying, like, who are your leaders, you know, things like that. You have a little look behind the curtain. What do you think happens when people make it, or, you know, I mean, obviously there's a lot of performers that are, you know, kicking in and getting down on, you know, even down on the ground. I don't remember his name, Jesse something, but I don't watch TV. So, but there's been some people actually just even in plain clothes, not trying to even be stars on the ground. But what is that disconnect, you know, between the actors and people who make it over the top that don't look back and try to do something, you know, or try to remember from whence they came, or, you know, in any kind of issue that might be out there?
You know, I think it's an interesting question. You know, I don't know specifically. I have an idea. My thought would be that I think, and I know a lot of friends who and colleagues of mine who are artists who have gotten a lot of success, and whether they're musicians or whatever. And I think there are some people who are able to sort of stay connected, whether that's staying connected with your family, or your friends, or your community, or you're from, or the people that matter to you, or issues. You know, Mark Ruffalo is a great example of an actor who's successful. And I was recently on an email chain for a salon that I'm part of, right, an activist salon. And he just came back and wrote us an email about the victories that they had in New York State and fights against fracking and things like that.
Right.
So there's an example of a guy who does do it, who has made a lot of money as an actor, but that still stays connected. But to your point, you know, there's a lot of people who don't. I have to say, I think that it is a overly consuming process to be a viable artist. I know this for a fact. You know, your entire life becomes so central to making your brand and making money for what you do. And it really becomes so centered about your work and yourself and your, you know, your fans, your website and your publicist, all this stuff, that you become so wrapped up. And that's where your mind is. You're not connected to what's happening, you know, in Cleveland when some 12-year-old gets shot. You're not, and that's not to say that you're not well-read or that you don't watch the news, but you're not as connected. I think the one benefit and the weakness, and I'll end with this, of being an independent artist, is that you're still connected to the real world.
Right.
Because you're an independent artist and you still feel what it feels like to have to pay bills. You still feel what it feels like that if you don't get a show, that you don't pay your student loan that month and that you get a notice. You know what that feels like when your car breaks down and it actually is going to hurt your pocketbook to get it fixed. Now, you're still an artist and you're still, quote-unquote, making money, but you're just like a working person. You're like just like that guy or that woman who's standing in line at a factory who's putting something on a brake pad. The only difference is the way that you do it. So I think the one benefit to that as an artist is that your art is better. And your stance on activism and your involvement in the community is better because you are part of that community. I think what happens when you quote unquote make it, or you make a lot of money, is you automatically
we're losing you a little bit there, Aaron. We might have to move a little
bit. Oh, sorry. How about? I just think that
everybody. The Twitter's not being fair today. Hey, Aaron, we just missed that, what you said. You may have to make a little move or something. I don't know if it's the Twitter or where you are.
how can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Okay.
And it's just the Twitter and the cell phone today are just battling a little bit. But, yeah, so you're saying, and I mean, I know that you do that, and we're going to get into that just now in a second here. But I think also that there's, what you said about the brand, and then you get people who are really successful artists, you know, they stand to lose a lot. I mean, there's a lot of people that are making money off, you know, that artist. You know, they travel with them, they work with them, they put them in movies or whatever, or do makeup on them. So, you know, there's a lot of jobs involved with that. So if you kind of say, well, I'm going to speak out on this, you're taking a chance with not only your own career, but with the careers of a lot of people that are around you.
Yeah, there's a lot to risk.
There's a lot of risk, but still it's just like anybody else. I mean, I know I have a bias because I get upset. I mean, someone like Oprah, she doesn't really stand to lose much. I would say, but I guess she would lose her brand, you know, but it's just weird to watch from here. I'm not that kind of artist at all. And I'm more indie myself, you know, just in nature. But I think that goes to what you do. I mean, you identify as a monologuist, you know, more than anything. And you were telling me before the show about some other shows that you've been developing, you know, since you did For Profit, and one of them was called The Science of Racism, which you drew from a real life incident. Do you want to talk a little bit about that and like that process of how being independent lets you draw from real life as opposed to scripts?
Yeah. And too, cause it's interesting cause I don't particularly sit down and like write a script and sit down with an idea. I know everyone has, I'm not a writer, trained writer, mm-hmm. you know? So for me, it's always just been, I take a lot of what I quote unquote write or put together from experiences. And so a lot of the time, and my experience in the last 3 years has taken me on the road, as I mentioned, doing 100 shows in 20 states. So I had a lot of time to think. I was in a lot of trains, planes, and automobiles. And so your mind kind of goes, and you encounter different situations. But yeah, I'm interested in stuff that I don't know. You know, that's the mm-hmm. thing is I'm not necessarily, when I write a piece or when I do a monologue, which is, I'm glad you mentioned monologism as a different thing. It's not acting. It is, you know, there's a performative nature, but there is a, like you said, there's a long form of, it's storytelling. It's
right.
crafted. It's definitely put together, but it has a different purpose and it has a different intimacy. But yeah, the piece that I wrote about has to do with the science of racism that I'm working on right now that I'm hoping to tour after I stop with For Profit. And I just don't want to be doing For Profit when I'm in my 60s in Vegas. I really don't at that point. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
The Catskills, maybe.
I mean,
I don't think Vegas
exactly.
is going to be around by the time you're 60, Aaron. Maybe the Catskills.
No, I'll be in Mohegan Sun. Don't worry, I'll be somewhere. But no, yeah, exactly. Or Horseshoe Casino downtown Cleveland. Here comes a student loan guy with his walker, right? But I don't want to get to that point. But at the same time, I'm very grateful for the success of the piece. But that being said, with this piece, Science of Racism, it's just an examination of an experience that I had with myself, and you know, being at a gas station and kind of being hustled by a guy who was trying to get some gas into his car. And I started thinking about some of the things that I was thinking during that situation, and I had to be honest with myself and go, wow, you know, even though I was raised by, you know, a single mother who was, you know, part of a union and a public school teacher and a hippie, and I watched Sesame Street and I believe in pluralism and Kumbaya and all that stuff, I still had this really visceral reaction when I was at this gas station getting hustled. And I lived in New York for 5 years. I know what it's like to get hustled. And
right.
at the same time, we as human beings naturally are always trying to protect ourselves. And so I think that's where the monologue comes from, is where is the difference between, you know, using stereotypes for a good thing, right? Like, so when you're walking down the alley and you see someone with a sharp object at 2 a.m. walking towards you, you could say, listen, I don't want to judge you.
Right.
I'm going to approach you like you're going, hey, wait a second. I've noticed a pattern here. I'm probably not going to walk up to the guy, no matter what color, who has a sharp object and a hoodie walking
right.
towards me at 2 a.m. in an alley. That's a good stereotype. The other kind, though, I think are more socially constructed, and they get blended in with the good ones. And so the science of racism is going to actually be me going around and talking to experts, and I want to get their information, and from people who are, you know, neuroscientists and different folks who are, you know, involved in these kind of studies, cultural and science, to figure out, does this kind of behavior that we have, not only can it be corrected, but is it part of our DNA? And if it's part of our DNA, how can we better ourselves in the future in terms of how we treat people? How can we use good stereotypes to keep ourselves well and safe and alive in our families and our communities? But how can we not let the negativity and the stereotypical stuff we see in the media and the fear of the other impact our lives? So that's what it's about.
Well, if it's in the DNA, we'll get to have a pill for it, I guess. That would be great.
Then I'll have another show, exactly.
Right, the pharmaceutical industry.
But, yeah.
that would be, you know, I wanted to ask you too, before we got off for profit completely, you said that you had done a filming of that, and that's been being shown around places. And I'm trying to figure out how that would go. I think of monologues as being, I mean, obviously Spalding Gray's monologues were filmed, but he was always sitting there just telling you a story. You know what I mean? I don't know. He might get up and walk around, as I recall. But, I mean, it was very camera-focused. I don't know. Maybe it's exactly the same. But does it translate the same or as well or as effectively as in person? Or is it just two different animals when you're doing it? Because it seems like, to me, the theater experience would be just so much more engaging, but better to just, you know, get it out there, too.
Yeah, the theater experience, the live performance is much more engaging. You're right. I prefer that. And I studied Spalding Gray as one of my, you know, idols in terms of storytelling. And I've watched his films. But that's the thing is he had filmmakers and cinematographers who were able to use their medium to really translate his vision and his story. He was a master storyteller, and he can do it with stillness and subtlety. I think it can be effective, and I'm exploring right now, you know, I updated on my biography or whatever that I want to really be in the next 5 to 10 years, really kind of brand myself as a multimedia monologist where I'm using audio, visual, and live performances to tell stories. And I think Spalding Gray set a precedent with that. So I think it can be effective. If you have a professional cinematographer and you have a budget and all that kind of stuff and lighting, I mean, that's the key. It has to be a production. We got some seed money from an organization to put a film together, and you know, it was effective. It wasn't obviously, you know, a Hollywood produced piece, but at the same time, it was better than just kind of putting up a camera and talking. For me, moving forward, you know, when I create more video pieces, I think what I want to do is make sure that we have them, that they're highly produced and they're effective, and that we have cinematographers and artists working on them and making it a piece. But this one served its purpose, which was they had a large Campus Equity Week that went across the country, and they just wanted the storytelling and the content from this play in an easy way, and I couldn't be in 35 places in a week. So the idea was, well, why don't we give you some money and why don't you just film this and try to make it as dynamic as possible with the limited budget that you have, and we'll screen it. And the most important thing about it for that Campus Equity Week, for that purpose, was not to be necessarily a performative experience. It was about discourse. And what it did for these campuses was they viewed it and they screened it, and then they used it as a way to have panel discussions and a discourse and an activism sort of a spontaneous sort of activism happen in these theaters. And it was crazy seeing the pictures. I had like sold out auditoriums in like California and stuff who were just watching it. So it was a really cool thing, and obviously for exposure and for my work individually, but more importantly for the discussion. So it served its purpose, but I think for me, if I'm going to use film and video, we're going to definitely craft it more artistically moving forward.
I like the raw thing, though. I think that's really cool. I mean, if you think about it, and you know, you've also started doing some storytelling workshops, as it says on your site. So I think that's great. But as I'm listening to you talk about that experience, I'm just thinking about how, there's just what you do is really kind of, it's like kind of a flow thing. You know, it's like it can serve a lot of different purposes. And you know, are you like is the gut and soul, heart and soul of Aaron Califato an actor or an activist? You know, I mean, where is it all coming from inside you? Is it like kind of like a twin, or is there more actor?
Well, I think for me, I think it started off being that I wanted to be an actor, whatever that means. What that really means is that I'm a kid from the Midwest, and I love watching movies, and I love Marlon Brando and Al Pacino. And so when I went to college, and I got my first play, I got an ego trip, and I said, "Man, this is great! I want to be a film actor." And then what happens? You I don't want to say grow up. I'm not talking about giving up on dreams, but for me. You get into that world, and you talk about the world of, you know, making it, all that kind of stuff. There's a world of art, and then there's a world of industry for art. And so
right.
I've been on that line, fortunately, but at the same time, kind of my time living in New York, it was just this constant grind. And I realized these actors who are these incredible artists, you know, you got one in a million who are actually able to have freedom in their art. The majority
right.
of people who are making money in this industry, it's soul sucking, and you don't.
Yeah.
And so I don't think I'm. So an actor is an artist. At the same time, to be a viable actor who makes money, you don't get to do a lot of art.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for me, I had a teacher. Her name was Olympia Dukakis, and she said to me during a session that we had, she asked me. She said, "Do you want to be an artist or do you want to be an entertainer?" And I said, "So this is kind of on your question about actor and actress." And I said, "I want to be an artist." And she said, "Well, then do art and go where artists are needed. They don't need you in New York."
Wow.
And she goes, "You know, I spent my life in New Jersey running a theater, having a family, going through struggles, and I finally got, you know, in film, you know, an Oscar when I was like in my 60s. But that was her. But she had an authentic life. And she
right.
told me to live an authentic life, which is a harder life, which is a life that's connected to the ground in places like Cleveland and Philadelphia and Detroit and across the Midwest and, you know, the Jersey Shore and these places. Go to these places. It's not that, you know, L.A. and New York, they're not wonderful. They're fine. But go
right.
to authentic places where artists are needed." And so that's what I did, because I think it wasn't about – so actor, activist, I think, you know, I guess I'm a performer, but I think more importantly I'm an activist, and I'm also just curious. I mean, just curious and concerned with the world, and also in love with it. I'm absolutely in love with it, because I think that I see the potential of people and society, and I also see the peril. And so I think that's where I'm at. It's just about, I'm more of, I don't know what you call it, like a researcher, because I just want to use this form to research the whys and the whens and how can we fix it.
That's, you know, because that's exactly what sort of I do, you know, with the show. I mean, I'm just like a curious person. I've always wanted to ask people questions about what they do on planes, trains, automobiles, the grocery store lines. It doesn't matter. I'm always like, "What are you up to? Why are you wearing that T-shirt?" But, you know, it can go from the mundane to the super intense. And I think, you know, I think basically you're describing, you know, being an artist, you know, analyzing all that, you know, what's around you and sharing it, you know, in a way that you're used to, and you have actor skills, and you have, you know, analytical skills that you bring to the table, and it's coming out in the form of these monologues, and which is interesting, because for both you and I over the past 2 years, and I, you know, this has been fascinating to me to watch happen. You know, is this podcast, these long form podcasts and storytelling things like The Moss and other shows, This American Life, so on and so forth. You know, there's been so many spinoffs now of that everything's going in a long form, kind of right on schedule, at least for me, because I started this podcast to be an hour long, and people are saying, "Well, that's too long." And I'm like, "No, it's not even long enough." But do you think people are starting to get more of an appetite for things that are in depth and have more tolerance for it than they did maybe 2 or 3 years ago?
Yeah, I think it's the same reason why people are moving to Cleveland. And we have like almost 100% occupancy rate downtown now. And in Northeast Ohio, it's not just because of the economy. It's not just because people can't afford to live in these sort of quote unquote more glamorous cities. I think people are starving for authenticity.
Mm.
And, you know, you go to Cleveland, you go 10 minutes south to a city called Parma, not Parma, Italy, Parma, Cleveland, and you got a guy walking around with a mullet and a Def Leppard T-shirt. That's about as authentic as it gets. I mean, that brother doesn't care. That guy is out there walking and is cool mm-hmm. with himself. He's not worried about wearing the shades inside. He is totally free. And I think when you come to Cleveland, you don't feel like a tourist. You feel like part of the family. You feel like part of the community. The point I'm making is that people are starving for authenticity, and I think the long form of storytelling. I grew up listening to Garrison Keillor, and that kind of stuff. Spalding Gray, and so I watch stand up comedy. So I love the long form of storytelling of the narrative. And you mentioned This American Life. Man, I listen to that. This is the stuff that drives the imagination and really feeds the appetite. And so I think in a world, especially now, look, we're using the digital format, right? But I think people are kind of getting tired of that. I think they just, it sometimes lacks authenticity because it becomes just about making an appropriate soundbite that fits this or that advertisers are attracted to. People are really attracted to it. So I think you're right. It's right on time. And I've noticed a great response from what I do. I mean, my monologues are an hour. I don't go in there and I don't turn into like Chekhov and make him sit there for 3 hours for a play. That's just straight up disrespectful of your time. I don't know what they were doing back then, but
that's a lot of ego right there.
right, exactly. Like,
well, it depends. I mean, if you can do 3 hours, that is it has a purpose. But if you're doing it to force people to watch, that's just there's a whole different way of doing it. Like Leaves of Grass has validity, right? Walt Whitman, like that's totally valid. But there aren't a lot of poems like that are as valid as that. for its own representationalism of grass being like there's a lot of blades, right? So I think it's brilliant, but it, like you said, it's not everything correlates so far. And I know the same thing is going on in Pittsburgh and a lot of other towns that I'm hearing about. Where people are, looking for, and then there seems to be like the completely ersatz, and then the kind of, well, we're not, but we are, kind of hipster thing. And maybe that's what hipster is, like we're not really hip, but we are. And then the like, well, we're not hip, so just come and hang out with us type thing, which are describing Cleveland and maybe Pittsburgh and some other cities in the United States. But do you notice a difference when you go into different towns and perform? Like people are receiving you differently based on where they are?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Most of the places I've been it's been positive, which is rare because sometimes, you go to a different place and they just don't want to hear it. I'm also a lot of times not always preaching to the choir. Sometimes mm-hmm. we have, people from different political viewpoints to come see the show. I'm not overtly political in my piece, and that's not my intention. But at the same time, I think what it does, and I think what long form does, and I think what my monologues in particular, my style, is it plays with the commonality of people. And I would just say that every place that I've been, we do question answer sessions and we do talk back sessions at the end of the show. And I think generally what I've noticed just from the specimen of audience members, that I've had in the last 3 years is that it mm-hmm. seems to me that people in general just want to be loved and fairness in their life. Like those are two common things. They just want love and fairness. Generally the desires of people across mm-hmm. all, spheres. And so that's the stuff that comes out of the conversations that I have. And then usually, we don't get so into the politics about who's right and left and right and all this stuff. We usually talk about, what it's like to, the struggle of trying to live up to your mom and dad to go to college, or the mom and dad are struggling to send their kids to college. And it's just, it plays to the nature of more of the deeper stuff inside about just being a human being and being sort of a vulnerable person and trying to make it in this world. And so I think, mm-hmm. Sometimes I would say, I've done a couple of places, I've gone south a couple of times, and there's been, sometimes in the audience it can be tough, but I don't want to stereotype the south, but from my experience, it's sometimes a little tougher crowd. Sometimes I'll have a little bit of a liberal slant with some of the stuff I do. I mean, it's not like Bill Maher, but that's not always well received. But at the same time, I think they see what I'm doing, and they see that what I'm trying to do is just be authentic and tell a story. I'm not trying to tell them to, vote for a particular politician. I'm not trying to do anything except say, hey, listen, can we kind of cut through all this other stuff and realize that we're just like people who are kind of involved in a system that's kind of hurting us, and I think it's up to us to change it. And I think people feel motivated just from that conversation, because most people are in a situation that they feel powerless, and then they feel like they can't do anything. And I would say that we absolutely can do something, and we have to do it at an individual basis. And once that happens, then collectively things will change. And right now, say, for instance, college, and I don't want to drone on, but for college, everyone goes, I hate the cost of tuition. Everyone keeps going to college.
Right.
I hate student loans. Everyone keeps getting student loans. Now, with those choices, there's going to be sacrifice. But see, most people are overcome by fear, me included, right? So, like, you don't like the fact that you have student loans, but you're afraid not to go to college because, you know, you want to get a good job. And there's that sort of fear and pressure. So I guess what I'm saying is it's exploring the conversation behind our motivations. And I think that's the one thing I also noticed that we have in common, too. People want to be loved. They want fairness. Mm-hmm. But most of us are afraid, including most of us are afraid. And I think it's pushing through the threshold of that fear. And the whistleblowers, right, or the person who steps out and say, hey, this is wrong, even if you're alone in that chorus. We need more of those people raising their hands and standing up and saying, you know what, I'm not going to poison the water for a few hundred extra dollars in my paycheck. I'm not going to do it.
Right.
Not going to exploit some kid in the inner city just so I can pay my monthly student payment. Well, guess what? You'll never be able to buy a house. I don't care. Because for me, if I can't sleep at night and I know that I'm hurting another human being and I'm hurting their experience, their metaphysical experience on this earth, their spiritual experience, their livelihood, and there's, if I'm essentially hurting their soul, it's not worth a dollar.
Right.
It's not worth a dollar. And so I think those, if we can manifest those kind of conversations, and that's what I'm getting in the audience, and I think just to kind of circle back completely, I think the long form does that in all its forms, is it asks us to re-examine, essentially re-examine ourselves and why we behave the way we do.
Yeah, that's something that I kind of struggle with myself. You know, Twitter, Facebook, they both have their different, you know, like, what are you going to call it? Like, just the way or the expected behaviors. And I think that, you know, you don't get – I know that I'm not feeling like interjecting what I really feel onto either page, number one, because, you know, they're just – it's the – you know, well, the spying factors, but, you know, not that I'm thinking of anything weird or anything like that, but it's just like, I don't need everybody somewhere to be knowing all my feelings. Like, I don't want to be that vulnerable, you know, in a kind of a, like a antiseptic forum. But then, you know, it seems like when you're saying the love and fairness and fear, like I can really identify with that. But when you know, the thing that trumps or triumphs over that or gets the voice then is the anger. And a lot of times, you know, it seems to me like people in both in social media forms, a lot of them, maybe, I don't know about Instagram or Tumblr because I haven't decided to go on and spread myself that thin. But that, you know, the, like, anger kind of rules the day. Do you think that has, you know, that it, like, love and fairness and fear, that's kind of harder to share than anger. Is that why they're so vitriolic sometimes, social media forms?
I think so. I think because anger is the layer before, like, love and fairness and fear. I think it's the layer before. I don't think it's directly interconnected like a yin and yang thing. I think that anger I love this kind of stuff because, see what I'm saying? The conversations like these, this is how I write the monologue. So it really is like questions about like these things. So like to go on this thread, like, yeah, I think that. Anger is just a manifestation or frustration based on sadness or based on, you know, not feeling loved or
grief.
A lack of those essential. Yes, you know, seriously, stuff like that. And then what do? You react in an angry way. When someone accuses you and you know that they're right and you're embarrassed and you feel shame, you react with anger. So, yeah, I think it's absolutely a form that is ripe for that kind of response. And that's why it is not as vulnerable. And that's why, for me, I chose the monologue form because – It is as organic as it gets, which is, and if you do it from a performative standpoint and as an actor, if you're doing it right, you essentially, you're not projecting to the audience. You're letting them in.
Exactly.
And, you know, great radio hosts and people who do what you're doing, they let people into the conversation and they let them into their experience. And that, That's a tough thing, and that's where the emotional sort of weariness comes from doing some of the work that I do, because when you do it, I'm not doing it every night, but I have 4 or 5 shows a month, and you're getting in front of, 100 to 300 people, and you're essentially just really opening up. It's a really vulnerable experience, but at the mm-hmm. same time, it's incredibly rewarding, because, the experience that all performers will tell you is that then the audience sees themselves in you. And that's where it transcends just this sort of like, hey, I went to a movie and saw Justin Bieber. Like, then it becomes a connective, collective, and I would say, just for lack of a better term, a spiritual experience, because it absolutely connects us on those common levels. And that's where you get a taste of, I think, what we're all sort of searching for. But how funny is it that we have to use just like, we have to turn off the lights, sit in chairs, and talk to each other on a stage to get there, right? I mean, all we need is a couple of, some smelling salts, and we'll be doing like a seance. I mean, it really is. We use weird forms to connect to our humanity, like movies, right? You go into a dark room, you turn off the lights, and you project images of people pretending to be real. And that's how we connect with our humanity. What a weird thing.
Right. And that's super valid. But it's super valid, super glorified, and all the rest. And it's very, there seems to be a wall there that isn't there when you're doing like a monologue or even like a radio show or something like that. But, because I was asking myself a question yesterday, like, why am I so cool with doing my show, but I've just been so uncomfortable, opening up on social media. And I think, someone recently had just opened up, about some, real deep issues on Twitter. And I was like sitting there thinking, I don't know how to respond to this. It's just like the wrong medium, it wasn't adding up for me. And then, someone else was having a really hard time yesterday and posted, and there was no way to even answer it. You couldn't star it. You couldn't like say, well, I'm really sorry about that, without seeming like it was a half a gesture. So it seems like some of the things that we've got ourselves plugged into as communication these days are just so empty, in a large way. I don't know. It's just, do you get that feeling? Because I don't see you doing a lot of stuff on Twitter. I do a lot of retweeting because I don't share that much stuff that I have to say. And whatever I do, it's roundly ignored. So I don't even try. But, what do you think about that, in terms of like the difference between face-to-face and, I mean, you just sort of said it. But, I mean, do you have a lot of love for the social media places? For doing things like sharing deep feelings or being vulnerable?
No, I don't usually use those platforms for the personal stuff. I mean, I think I'll have witty, insights to stuff, or I'll have, maybe a statement about just generalities, but not in terms of like a deep personal stuff. My preference is not to use those venues that way because of the artificial nature of it. I use it for promotional aspects. I like, the great thing about it is that, a lot of it, some of it might be stealing your information, but it's also free for the independent artist. So, you have this platform that, you don't have to pay to play anymore, so to speak. It actually levels the playing ground for a lot of people, who don't have privilege or things like that. So that's a nice thing about it. Sharing of it and the actual exchange of human interaction. I don't think it's a great medium for that kind of stuff. People do. I don't like it that way. What I really like though is that, that's why.
Oh, we lost Aaron, so we're going to give him a call back. It'd be very quick here. Hold on 1 second. Hope you're enjoying today's show. I know I am. Aaron's a great guy. You got to go see his show if he's coming near you. So check him out on the promo piece. Lost you, babe. We lost you, hon. So I had to just call you right back.
No, and so I think that was technology fighting back, right? It was like,
yeah,
how
exactly.
Dare you,
technology
how
saying, hey, Rick, you're dead. Don't try and be vulnerable on Blog Talk Radio either. Smartass.
Twitter had us. Yeah. So I think, just to put a cap on it. Yeah, I think. That's the beauty of the live performance is, you see people and they interact with you and you look into their eyes, they look into your eyes and it's just really incredible exchange. And it's real. And if done correctly, and I don't want to say that there's a, so to speak, right or wrong, but if done correctly and if it's an organic experience and the topic is good and the audience is mature and they're willing to listen and the artist is mature and willing to listen in a way too, there is no greater connection, I think, for me, besides, you know, your family and stuff like that. There's no greater connection because everyone leaves, I'll end with this, everybody leaves their masks outside the door. Most of them do. And sometimes some of them have, you know, they take them off. What I say by masks are the stuff that we wear to protect ourselves, you know, the professions and the money we make and, you know, what that person did to me today and the anger and all that stuff. And usually, you know, when you're talking to someone in a form like that, they release that. They let that go. And then they're just them. They're just them. And the real them, not the...
Right.
The money or the suit or the tie or the all this stuff or the social status. They're just a human being sitting there. And next thing you know, you just got a group of human beings exchanging what it's like to be human.
Yeah.
And that's as, I think, therapeutic and as important as it gets. And that's why I do what I do. And obviously stuff like money and money gets in the way of that.
Right.
And so you try to figure out ways to get paid so you can just say, okay, let's get that out of the way so I can have this really authentic experience.
I think, you know, it is like therapy, you know, because people do, you know, whenever you let your hair down, that's like being in, you know, in that real vulnerable, trusting situation. And that's where I think, you know, theater and the performing arts do bring people. Same thing with art and even photography. I often wish I was a photographer because, or even you, because, I mean, you get an immediate response from the people that you entertain or, you know, perform for. And I know here I just, you know, I don't know who's listening or what they're thinking or if they're even getting anything out of it. And that's my big frustration with what I do. And I'm trying to figure out how to make that happen. But, you know, it's just a place where people can just open up. But then I was just thinking, you know, after your show, how they leave the door. And then, like, if you could just do a picture of them, like, assuming their personhood again, you know, and they leave the door, you know, or their humanhood, you know, because they've got to go back to real life. But it's good to let it down and be in that space, you know, for at least a couple of times a year, I would think. But that's why people go and see art. But, you know, I'm thinking that, you know, the role of theater, we've been talking about, you know, it's so key to activism. And it seems like it would be so much more authentic than, you know, some of the just like tweeting or Facebooking or even, you know, and some people have started to do the Google Hangouts. Like last night there was a big Google Hangout on what's next for Ferguson. You know, there is some real push and drive to get the face-to-face time. And realize that maybe, you know, that belongs in there too. So as far as like the role of theater and social change, you know, I think it could have a much bigger role based on some of the things that you are doing. Have you thought about expanding in that direction or, you know, working with other people who do training for activists, thing like that?
Yeah, so I mean, we actually, ironically, I'm glad you brought it up, working with an organization called TCG, Theater Communications Group, and they're kind of myself and a couple of other actors and producers and who are socially minded, they kind of tasked us with this initiative to basically put together a program and put together a campaign, if you will, to encourage regional theaters around the country to not only host socially minded solo theater and monologues and socially conscious theater to begin with, but to have it be a very important part of their program, and also to convince them or talk with them about the how that it could be actually good business. That by interconnecting with community organizations and having panel discussions and building new partnerships with audiences that don't necessarily always go to theater or see theater as a viable tool for social change, you can actually build new audiences and create new revenue streams. So that's what we're working on. We're in the initial phases of that right now. We're going to be doing some presentations at national conferences in the next few months. And actually, ironically, there's a national conference in Cleveland that I'm going to be presenting at in the summer. So, yeah, to your point, yes, absolutely. That conversation has now permeated the theater world, and there's always been socially conscious theater. It's just now, can we figure out a way to connect in a much more larger macro way, and can we partner with arts-hosting organizations and theaters to not just say, yeah, let's just bring this, you know, socially conscious guy in and does his piece for a weekend, Can you make it part of your program? And can you see the economic benefit of that and the social benefit of that? Can we have those two things run parallel? And I think we can.
Well, are there a lot more Aaron Califatos out there doing monologues and putting together pieces like you that you do that would be able to plug into that right away, or do they need to be cultivated as well?
No, I think there. I would say that there's not a ton of artists doing this type of form. There are some, certainly, and there's some doing it very effectively. One of my, and you should have him, I'll introduce you, his name is Michael Milligan, and he's an actor, but he wrote a solo play. I don't think he identifies as a monologist like I do, but he's an actor, he's wrote a solo play, and it's about the healthcare industry. It's been really effective, and he and I actually are part of this working group. There are absolutely artists out there who are doing great work. They may not be monologists, because I think it's kind of a rare form, but there are absolutely artists out there doing this kind of work. It's just kind of about creating a structure and a best practice to connect us and then connect us with resources and put us in a position to showcase this work and effectively use it to leverage things that we want to see in the community. And so it's a process, but I think this sort of initiative and having a group like TCG, Theater Communications Group, spearhead this and kind of throw us their support and their name is a really big step in the right direction.
Wow. Well, I'm totally on board with that. I'd love to have TCG on if they want to come on and talk about that. That would be great, because I think it's really important. Because people, I think they see the theater as like a place to go and be entertained or... I can't afford it anyway. So, you know, I mean, I think it's also expensive. It seems like out of reach in so many ways, but not a place to go and get that therapy that you're talking about. You know, that would be wonderful if there was more of that and it was more affordable. I know in New York they used to have like Shakespeare in the parking lot and things like that that were pretty cool. But it always seemed like there was a wall between, you know, me and whoever the performers were, whereas you don't get that in kind of solo plays or more intimate theater. So I know that you have an invitation coming up to the American Association of University Professors Centennial Conference at Columbia University in April. So we want to congratulate you on that. Are you going to be doing your monologue there?
Yeah, so I'm doing it there. And again, it's just kind of another example of cross-pollinating, as you said pre-show. Mm-hmm. You know, taking a monologue that talks about, you know, equity and fairness in higher education and then linking that to labor when it comes to university professors. I mean, there's a statistic out there, I think it's like 70% of people who are teachers at universities are adjuncts, so they're part-time. 70% are part-time workers, and they're making very, very little money for a lot of work. And so, you know, you have this system in which, you know, students are being destroyed with debt even before they start school and then afterwards, and which is hurting their citizenship, it's hurting their economic viability post-graduation. Then you have the people teaching them, at least 70% of them, who are living on poverty wages, and you're going, where's the money going? Where's the money going, right? So that's a whole other show. But I guess the point is that's what this is. I'm bringing this, I'm trying to use this as a way to connect the student struggle with the labor and the adjunct and the struggle that teachers have gone through for years in this venue. So yeah, I'm excited about that. And we got a bunch of other colleges that next few weeks we'll be kind of announcing that we're going to. So it'll be a fun spring. I'm looking forward to it. I'm also looking forward to doing new work. That's the other thing. So
yeah.
I'm looking forward to some of my new monologues, but this is great.
Well, we're gonna have you on sooner than 2 years from now. We're going to revisit you maybe later, a couple of months from now, see what's going on, Aaron, because you're so interesting and wonderful to talk to. I just appreciate all the work that you do. I know that it's all from the heart, and it's been a great blessing to do Talkupy and meet people like you, and especially you in particular. So we're welcome back anytime, and we'll get TCG on. We'll try to help you out. And I know you got places to go, things to do today, so we'll let you move on. Where should people look for you? What's your website?
It's just my name, AaronCalafato.com.
Okay. And we have a lot of links to it that you can reach Aaron on the promo. Thanks, Aaron. Have a great day. And thanks again for being on.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, that was Aaron and Califato. I hope that you'll check him out. Check out For Profit. Unbelievable show and concept. And so much new ground that Aaron is digging up and getting us to the place where we need to be, which is vulnerable. Hey, what about that? Very difficult time to even imagine that, but that's where we need to go. And a lot of artists out there and social and activists are moving in that direction. Some know it, some don't. But we're here on Talkupy to offer that kind of discussion to you going forward. Next week, we are going to have two great shows, one with Robin Mello of Philadelphia Orchard Project, and to be with Occupy Vacant Lots, and she's going to be a revisiting guest as well. Robin was like one of my absolute favorite shows of all time. And, will be joining us on Thursday. She's going to talk about how they're trying to stop fracking from beginning, from getting into the Southern Illinois Shawnee National Forest, which is down where I went to school. So very, very close to me. And just some other great shows are stacking up. This Sunday, actually, too, we are going to have George Chu back on, Dr. J, who was on with Giles Clark, my friend, talking about his work as a paramedic in Guatemala, and they got him a new truck, and oh my God, the truck got in a car wreck, and now they're trying to put it back together. So we're going to do a little update with Dr. George, Dr. Jorge. Hopefully you can listen in on that. Everybody have a great day and be the change. Thanks to Earth Guardians for their song. You gotta feel the change,